Hello, everyone. Thank you once again for joining us for yet another episode of Mass Office Hours. We record live. We record every Wednesday night, me and another member of the Mass team. And the whole premise, if you're new to the show here, is we like to chat about fitness and science and answer questions from the good people like you who have submitted a question ahead of time or who are joining us in the live chat. So tonight, I am joined by the legendary Dr. Eric Helms. Helms, how you doing?
Oh, just feeling blessed to be called a legend by someone of your caliber. So thank you very much. I'm doing well. It's always good to see your face.
Absolutely. And this is going to be an interesting episode because I was thinking for about an hour, we do have a hard stop. This is going to be a shorter episode. We would just trade compliments back and forth. And I think people would get a lot out of that. And I know you and I would certainly get a lot out of that with our shared narcissism.
You know what? I think if there's anyone who's a better narcissist in this conversation, it's you, buddy. So we'll start with that.
all right, Helms. As has, you know, something that has become a bit of a custom on this show is to start out, we have a bit of a segment of prepared content talking about something that's on our mind. And one thing that's been on my mind lately is consuming a bunch of expandable gel capsules. That's something that when I wake up, I think, you know what I'd like to do today is jam a bunch of capsules down my gullet to expand in my stomach and make me eat less. And that kind of sounds like science fiction, but it's actually just kind of good old-fashioned science now. If you're a Mass subscriber, and if you're not, folks, head over to massresearchreview.com, check it out. In a recent Mass article, it was a research brief, I talked about a new study by Liu and colleagues. And the title of my article or my brief on it was Filling Your Stomach with Gel Capsules to Reduce Energy Intake. So this was a new study in a big multi-center trial that came out of China. It was randomized, double-blind, and placebo-controlled. So, you know, as long as it's done well, that's a high level on the hierarchy of evidence. You know, we can make some real solid inferences from that type of study design. And this study included weight-stable adults between the ages of 18 to 60, with BMI values ranging from 24 to 40. A fairly kind of broad general population type of sample here. You know, they excluded folks who were taking medications that might have interfered with study, people who were taking medications to intentionally induce weight gain or weight loss. So in total, they had 280 eligible participants who were randomized into one of two groups. And when you do a multi-center trial, that is the benefit. You can actually say, hey, we're going to recruit hundreds of people, you know, in this case, 280, rather than the 20 most ambitious undergraduate college students who happened to see my flyer when they were walking into the gym, right? So 280 folks, and there were these two groups that they were randomized to, one or the other. One of them was taking a placebo. The other group was consuming what they called intragastric expandable capsules. They took those twice daily for 24 weeks. So they would take four capsules with about half a liter of water, and they would take those 30 minutes before lunch and 30 minutes before dinner. And then both of these groups received individualized counseling related to diet and exercise, and they would kind of update it every 4 weeks throughout the trial. So, you know, general kind of lifestyle intervention, one group is taking these gel capsules, the other group is not. Now, a question that is probably on your mind if you're listening, certainly a question that came up for me is, the heck are these capsules? What's this all about? You know, like this kind of caught me off guard, came out of left field a little bit. So they were made from two natural food grade components, and those are carboxymethylcellulose and citric acid. So if you're one of those folks who makes the Instagram infographics I always see saying that clearly something with a small number of ingredients is both healthy and natural, boom, these are for you. Two ingredients. What could be better, right? So, the idea was you take these orally before a meal with water, about 30 minutes before a meal. And if that sounds familiar, it's because there is a pretty substantial literature looking at a variety of different preloads before meals. So sometimes people say, hey, we're going to have you drink a bunch of water half an hour before this meal and see if you eat less. Sometimes they'll do a protein shake half an hour before a meal to see if it impacts how much food you choose to eat or just your appetite and satiety responses. So same kind of deal, but in this case, instead of water or protein, it's these gel capsules. And the idea is that they basically, they hit the stomach and start to expand into this, what they call a three-dimensional polymer matrix that absorbs a bunch of water and grows in volume. And so in this case, when you're consuming four capsules before lunch and four capsules before dinner, it's supposed to expand to a volume of approximately 200 milliliters. So that's a substantial displacement of volume within the stomach, not a small amount. And so they said that usually that would occupy about one quarter of the average human stomach volume, average adult human stomach volume. And so the idea was pretty simple. You take these capsules, they interact with water in the stomach, they expand, take up about a quarter of your stomach, you eat less during the meal, and then the expanded gel particles eventually just break down in the colon, the water gets reabsorbed, and the hydrogel is then eliminated through bowel movements. So with that in mind, my first thoughts when I saw this study, first of all, what the heck are these capsules? We got that covered. Second of all, I was really intently focused when I read this study on adverse events. And that makes it sound like somebody died, but adverse event could be very, very mild in a study. It could be very severe in a study. It's just the number of, you know, stuff that would happen on a form where you say, you know what, I took this and I had a tummy ache, or I had headaches every day during this study, or I had a severe cardiac event and was rushed to the hospital, right? It could be this whole spectrum that would all fall under adverse events. And they did very thorough reporting of adverse events in this study. I was expecting something in the ballpark of GI discomfort, GI pain, stomach pain, perhaps malabsorption of water or nutrients, of just having this random inert stuff kind of filling up your stomach. You know, I mean,
constipation,
you know, very strange stool consistency, maybe. You know, I was really looking for people to genuinely hate this intervention. And it's just one study, so of course we'd like to see it replicated before we, you know, make a whole lot of important decisions based on this. Frankly, I don't even know where you'd hope even attempt to get these. I haven't really looked into that. But you know, I'd like to see more replication before I get too excited. But at least in this study, they did report adverse events very extensively, and I was really stunned to see that the results were not too bad in terms of, you know, adverse event outcomes. It was pretty well tolerated, you know, across the board. So I was really, really surprised to see that this was a well-tolerated intervention. And more notable, more, well, I wouldn't say more notable, but more central to the question being investigated, these capsules actually did lead to substantially more weight loss over this 24-week period. So for example, if we look at the body weight change from baseline to week 24, you know, the folks who were in the placebo group, you know, if you're going by, I'll just go per protocol. I think that's most relevant here. So the placebo group lost about 2.5 kilograms over 24 weeks because this was, you know, they had that nutrition and diet counseling or and exercise counseling. So 2.5 kilograms, not too bad. But the group that was consuming these capsules actually lost a little over 6 kilograms, 6.1 kilograms over this 24-week period. So that's a very considerable weight loss for that period of time.
Yeah.
When you're considering, you know, this type of study where it's not like a experienced dieter who's doing their cut for the season, right? So I, you know, and of course in the article I go down the line and talk about some other metrics. They, you know, they looked at BMI, waist circumference, a bunch of other endpoints related to adiposity. But my main takeaway from this study was I was pleasantly surprised to see that this intervention was well tolerated, to see that it seemed to be pretty effective. You know, nothing that is like totally outside the realm of possibility, because that's a bad thing for me. When I read a study and I'm reviewing one right now, that it's like, yeah, I don't want the results to be that good. It kind of sends, you know, the red flags are kind of all over the place. This is a totally plausible number to, from my perspective over this time range. And yeah, so I was really pleasantly surprised to see the results of this. And I know a lot of folks will be hearing this and say, well, okay, great. So I just wait around for 4 years and see if this ever gets approved and see if it ever becomes broadly available and affordable and all that stuff. Well, that's not necessarily the only way to apply these findings, in my opinion. And I do want to put a big caveat here. I am leaving the realm of analyzing this study and entering the realm of speculating. I am looking at a finding of a very unique gel capsule and say, okay, maybe in a speculative manner, we can leverage this in a way that would be useful with a slightly different intervention. So when you look at the research on water preloads and protein shake preloads, I wouldn't necessarily say that they do nothing, but it's pretty underwhelming, right? It's not a really substantial weight loss that we typically observe when we have people drink some water before a meal or drink a protein shake before a meal. But this study suggests that, well, if we can manage to fill up space in the stomach before the meal, about 30 minutes before, that seems to really do something, you know. But and these gels obviously take up more volume for a longer period of time than just having a, you know, a protein shake or a drink of water. So my thought actually dates back or kind of connects back to another mass research brief that I did previously about a really cool paper looking at what seems to be the signal that actually induces the termination of a meal. And so you'd think, oh, it's easy. You eat a bunch and then you stop eating, right? Well, but what does that mean, eat a bunch? It can mean you're eating a bunch of calories or you're eating just a bunch of physical mass of food, right? And so there's a really, really fantastic paper by Flynn and colleagues where they looked at, they kind of created a theoretical model about what really causes us to terminate a meal. What's that dominating signal? And when we are eating a meal with really high energy density, it seems to be calorie content, right? So think about, for example, eating a ridiculous amount of cheesecake for you, and an amount of cheesecake that you'd say, I'm going to feel like crap after I'm done with this. If you replace that volume with watermelon, would you necessarily feel like crap after eating that watermelon? Probably not, right? It's the calories in this super energy-rich food that once you hit a certain number of calories in one sitting, you're like, okay, I feel like I just had my Thanksgiving dinner for folks in the States who celebrate, like, I'm done, right? And it doesn't necessarily have to be a volume or mass of food that totally fills your stomach. However, if the energy density of the food or meal that you're eating, whether you're eating a single food or a meal of many foods, the overall energy density, if it's very low, then it seems to be once you reach a certain volume of food intake or a certain mass of food intake, that's when you basically reach your point. You say, okay, I can't eat anymore. So like if I told you, hey, you're going to be eating, you know, chopped up cucumbers, you can't just eat that infinitely, right? You're not going to sit here and eat, you know, 1900 calories worth of cucumbers. Like it's just not going to happen. You're going to fill up well before that calorie sensor really kicks in and says, hey, you're done eating. So there's clearly this kind of, there are these two different signals, and which one dominates really depends on the energy density of the meal. And Flynn and colleagues suggested that when the overall meal energy density starts getting near about 2-ish, 1.75, 2, and that's the units are kilocalories per gram. That's how we usually calculate energy density. So you, calories of the meal divided by the mass of the meal. Usually around 1.75 or 2 is where we start to find that the calorie signal is the dominant signal. So what I would propose, kind of having these two studies, holding them both simultaneously in our mind, is, you know, what if we talked about preloads, just thinking about preloading with a food with exceptionally low energy density, because that's basically what these gel capsules are trying to do. It'd be like if you're snacking on a food with very, very low energy density, either 30 minutes before a meal or perhaps at the beginning of a meal, like, you know, the classic, like, I always like to eat my vegetables first, get them out of the way, move on to the good stuff. Perhaps there's something to that. And if you're thinking about what kind of foods might make sense for that, you know, you're thinking things like cucumber, tomato, celery, broccoli, watermelon, foods that have just exceptionally low energy density. So one thing I want to highlight here, though, for people who are thinking about trying this out, and again, the benefit here theoretically would be that you're filling your stomach, and then when you move on to the more calorically dense foods, you consume less of it, but you still feel nice and satiated when you terminate that meal. The thing I want to really caution here, two things. First of all, 200 milliliters is the volume in the stomach, right? So it's not like you can take a 200 milliliter volume of watermelon, eat it, and say, oh, I'm sure that's still 200 millimeters or milliliters, right? Because you're going to be grinding that up with your teeth. You're going to be chewing it, and the volume is going to shrink considerably, right? So without question, it would take a pretty substantial amount of food to try to get anywhere near this kind of 200 milliliter volume. So this isn't just having a couple carrots before your meal. If you're trying to replicate, you know, the fairly substantial effect that we see with these capsules. So that would be one challenge. Another challenge is, like I said, when you look at the totality of the meal, that's where the energy density curve kind of fits. And so, like, I guess the easiest way to say that is to keep it practical, the point that I'm trying to make here, which is that, okay, you do this preload, and let's say you do enough of it to fill a quarter of your stomach. Well, if the meal following it is that massive serving of cheesecake, you still might hit that calorie intake before you might hit that calorie limit before you actually hit the food volume limit, in which case I wouldn't expect this to do a doggone thing, Helms. So the only way they could really hope to apply this for now would be to have a fairly substantial preload with low energy density foods, very low energy density, and then follow up that with a meal that still has fairly low energy density, and perhaps you might be able to leverage this. But looking forward into the future, I think it's really interesting. First of all, like, I know basic studies, sometimes people are like, who cares? I can't use this yet. I can't go down to Vitamin Shop and get my gel capsules, so what do I care? It's really valuable to get an understanding of how we may theoretically, in principle, have a meaningful effect on you know, ad libitum food intake, because then, you know, that's where more applicable strategies may be developed down the line. So I think it's really interesting. I think there's some potential here. And I'd really love, Helms, if I had infinite money and time and wasn't afraid to do a study that would be very cumbersome to get rolling, I'd be really thrilled to see a study where perhaps you couple this with this kind of new generations of GLP-1 weight loss drugs.
Yes.
And now we're really cooking, man. I mean, when you're talking about, especially because, you know, we do tend to see some plateauing with those weight loss drugs. You know, what happens if we, you know, use those weight loss drugs, and as their kind of weight loss effects start tapering off a little bit, we introduce kind of step two of this intervention. I don't know. I think we could see, like, you know, these GLP-1 agonists are already remarkably effective. And if we could layer in another very effective, not quite as effective, but very effective intervention on top of that, which essentially is working in a similar manner to limit food intake, boost satiety, things like that, I think it'd be really fascinating. And ultimately, at the end of the day, my dream for the fitness industry as a whole, the fitness world, is that we have a much larger tent and we have more people joining the show, right? And I think one of the things that's really prohibitive of that is folks who, they're like, you know, if I could get down, you know, and lose 150 pounds, sure, I'd be active as, you know, as anybody. You know, I'd be thrilled to dive into some more hobbies and activities that are active, get involved with this club and that club and play sports and get into lifting and all this stuff. But a lot of people really struggle with that first effort of, you know, it's tough to do that stuff when I feel like I have about 100, 150 pounds to lose and my body doesn't move the way I want it to. It's prohibitive for some of these physical activities I enjoy doing. So I know, like, when the GLP-1 drugs started to make some waves in the research, a lot of, like, fitness coaches were like, whoa, if there's a drug that can replace me, we're all screwed. And I was like, are you kidding me? You know how many people would love to engage with fitness at a higher level if only they could get over that first hump of losing, you know, that first 30, 35, 40 pounds and get the ball rolling? So, yeah, I'm really excited by these types of interventions. This one's a little wacky, I'll admit. I don't know if it's going to pan out, but
It's wacky, but I will just say, because I think there are some parallels that might be worth pointing out, Trex. If you don't mind me jumping in a bit, I know you're on a roll. Okay, cool. So, have you ever used psyllium husk? or made that or mixed it into a drink before?
I think I've mixed it before. Yeah, it gets all like jelly kind of like.
Yeah. So I think this is a really good way to illustrate what you're talking about, where, you know, you look at a watermelon, you think, how could that ever fit in my stomach? But just the process of chewing it, it ends up separating the water from the actual content of the food. So the impact of these gel capsules is probably greater than eating a bowl of broccoli, right? But we do know that fiber and even water preloads do have some effect. So when you're having essentially a low calorie food like a fruit or a vegetable, there is some matter in bulk that's sitting in your stomach, and you get the effect of a water preload. It has some small benefit. And we generally see that diets that consist of lower energy densities result in passive weight loss. And if you look at, say, vegetarians on average, they maintain a lower body weight than their omnivorous counterparts, probably due to this, but it's not huge. We're talking a kilo or two on average in absolute terms. However, if you're wondering what the heck we're talking about, where a food actually gets bigger in the stomach, go ahead, get some psyllium husk powder if you have it, mix it, and then instead of drinking it while it's still mixing, because it's a soluble fiber, let it sit for a bit. And what you'll see is that powder actually absorbs water and takes on like this ball. And it's not expanding to the same degree of like a capsule becoming 200 mils, but something similar. And there actually has been research on psyllium husk preloads. Not a tremendous amount, but you might have noticed I was on my phone while you were talking. And that's not just because I have no respect for you. That's just kidding. It's because I actually was like, I wonder if people have done preloads with psyllium husks. And one study, for example, by Brahm and colleagues in 2016, published in, you know, appropriately in Appetite, satiety effects of psyllium in healthy volunteers. And they compared 3.4, 6.8, and 10.2 grams of psyllium husk taken before breakfast and lunch for 3 days. And they looked at the satiety effects. And I think there's basically a plateau and even more consistent findings of the 6.8 gram dosage. And having actually mixed that amount, it bulks up pretty good. You know, you're getting basically like a fist size, which is way larger than 8 grams of powder, right? Of kind of this congealed water gel-like, you know, powder. It's not powder anymore, but it is. That's what soluble fiber does in the gut, and why sometimes you'll feel a little more full for longer having oats versus, say, white rice, even if the carb and even sometimes the fiber content is matched because of the type of fiber.
Yeah.
So this is not too dissimilar from some people who have tried and experimented with psyllium husk as a preload. And I think that can kind of help you understand why this isn't too crazy of an idea.
Yeah.
But it is probably a more effective way of getting to the same thing. And the last thing I would say is we should note that we are speculating, and even the paper you referred to that kind of looked at the two signals, energy and also energy density, as what's going to dictate when you stop a meal. I wish it was that simple, and I'm sure you do too.
Oh, yeah.
But I recently covered, and we talked about this on Iron Culture, for those who want to watch that episode, Brian Wansink's data, the much maligned researcher from Cornell. He actually had one of his earlier studies replicated on the bottomless soup bowls, where they had participants come in and they had basically a vacuum tube at the bottom hidden to the soup bowl. So it's the endless soup bowl. And they try to figure out when do people stop eating. And what did replicate was that when that soup bowl constantly refills, people eat more. So it's not just the calorie content or the energy density, because a tomato soup is both low energy density, and they also end up consuming more when they couldn't tell how much they were done. There are visual cues, and there's normative factors, social factors, environmental factors, purposeful self-regulation that people do, emotional status. So there's a tremendous amount that goes into why we might finish a meal. But one of them actually is the gastric stretch. And there was another study that I was looking at that was, and this connects nicely to the GLP-1 agonist that you were discussing, like semaglutide, for example. When you look at some of the gut hormone responses to fiber supplementation with psyllium husk, they actually release some of these same related things that the mechanism of action of the drug. When you look at the gastric hormones that are related to satiety, they get released in response to taking psyllium husk. So I think it's a very reasonable speculation to say, hey, maybe we don't want to take semaglutide for forever, because there are some, you know, adverse effects related to it. And again, that doesn't mean death, like you were saying. And if we can replace that with a benign or comparatively benign fiber supplement or hydrogel capsules that can be taken long term, and this should be very cheap, what we're talking about here.
Yeah.
In either case. And I think absolutely that there is potential here that is worth noting, and all the terms and conditions apply. You know, first study, higher magnitude of effect observed, needs to be replicated in a larger sample outside of this lab, et cetera, et cetera. But I think it's definitely an area where we should be hopeful and keep an eye on the space.
Absolutely. Now, Helms, I'm obligated contractually to mention, folks, if you like the show, there's many ways to support it, and we love all the support we can get. Make sure you like, rate, subscribe, review wherever you get it. Share it with friends. Post it far and wide. Make sure everybody knows about it. You can submit questions for us to answer if you go to the link in the description of this show. That question portal is open year-round, 24/7, 365. But of course, the best way to ask a question is to jump in the live chat on YouTube Wednesday nights at 7 p.m. Eastern. So thanks to everyone in the live chat who has joined us. Of course, we've got the hashtags going. Hashtag Eric Entourage, hashtag Eric Ensemble, Eric Squared, Squaric, which is a new one. I like that a lot. Ashley said she can't stick around, but she wanted to join the beginning, and, you know, wishes we're doing well. Thanks so much, Ashley, for popping in. We appreciate it. Hopefully you can hear it on the replay whenever it suits your needs. You can catch it on YouTube after the fact, and of course on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, all that good stuff. Let's see here. Someone asked, when am I going to have a book out? Because obviously Helms has his Pyramids books that are fan favorites, much loved in the fitness industry, and he's got his new editions on the way. For me personally, don't put that on me. That's a horrible thing to do to someone like me.
I will say, though, Trex, you did tentatively agree, and you may have forgot, that you would act as a editor for my third edition of the books, doing some peer review.
That is true. So I'm good for it.
You're going to be a significant contributor to the third edition.
Okay, cool. Yeah, you are getting me off the hook then, because an original book for me. I know I had talked about doing that in the past, so I brought this on myself, but that was before I re-entered the lab-based science world, and now it would be a tremendous disservice to the people who pay my salary if I just said, forget all that work to be done in the lab. I'm going to write a book, you know? The way my position is structured, that would not be a good use of my time, and I'm sure people would say, hey, Eric, maybe write some papers would be nice, you know?
Yeah.
All right. Let's see. Wow. Ethan moved his university class schedule just to catch these live. Ethan, you are a true hero.
And I don't know that I recommend doing that, but I...
Oh, yeah. We're supposed to be pro-education and all that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You skipped office hours to come to office hours. Is that good? All I know is that I appreciate it.
Absolutely. Yeah. So, Todd said he eats two mandarins and has a sparkling water before third and fourth meal of the day and notices a positive effect. And yeah, that makes sense. You know, I think definitely leveraging some of the stuff we're talking about in this episode for sure. So good to hear that. Simon feels very differently because Simon is trying to bulk. Definitely, if you're trying to bulk, this type of strategy would be your worst nightmare. Not ideal. It's just going to make your life harder. So definitely not for bulking. There's a stats question. I'm going to have to come back to that one. Let's see here. Someone asked a question. Kim asked, does this idea, and it, Helms, I appreciate that you pointed out, you know, there's this theoretical model, and I did use the word theoretical, yep, that as the energy density of a meal gets up above 1.7 or 2, the primary signal dictating meal termination shifts from that stretching of the stomach from increased food volume over to just calorie sensing, high amount of energy coming in. And like you said, we can override that, you know, by, you know, the hedonic kind of rewarding elements of food intake, visual cues, social cues, all that other stuff. The fact that they gave you 10 chicken nuggets and you really probably would have eaten 8, but hey, there's two more. Who's going to put those away, right? So there's all these other things that can impact our food intake, but the question was about that 1.75 to 2, I won't call it a break point, but that kind of transition area, so to speak. does that take into account the fluid along with the meal? It would not take into account beverages, like if you had a glass of water with it. But the way that they calculate energy density would be the grams of the food, or the calories of the food divided by the grams of the food. So that would impact the grams of the food if it's the liquid component of the food item itself. So the answer, you know, do they account for fluid? Kind of in some cases, right? So that is kind of purely referring to the energy density of that meal. I don't think you would add, if you had a bunch of water in the meal, I don't think you'd add that in. I think this is kind of exclusively or mostly predominantly focusing on, we got a little thing coming up in the chat here.
So Trex, I don't know if it'd be helpful to people asking questions, because energy density is not something we often think about, and it's a relatively infrequently discussed topic in the nutrition world. I got a little infographic. I don't know if you have the capability of putting it up on screen, but I will fill. Amazing.
I don't know how to get it off, but I put it up. So that's a leader problem.
So we are, I want to see what that looks like while you're talking when I look at the YouTube. But energy density is literally just taking the food and then just simply dividing its mass by its energy content, and it gives you a value. And to give you an idea of what is an energy density around that 1.5 or 2 mark that we're talking about, we're talking about most fruits or most lean proteins is right around where we're sitting there. Like, I think a banana is probably an energy density of 2-ish.
Yeah.
And that's kind of when that theoretical model switches over more towards the energy content. And it is definitely true, and it's been consistently observed. I would encourage everyone to check out some of Barbara Roll's research, which goes back decades, that if you consume diets that consist more of lower energy density foods, your habitual intake of energy is typically lower, and it will result in passive weight loss that then starts to plateau on average. But it really does depend upon who the person is, their situation, all the above. And you can see right here, we've got an infographic, shout out to My Sports Science, that I just stole off Google. We are citing our source as to hopefully not be sued. But you can see, like, very low energy density. All of those are, you know, less than 1. And we're talking about most vegetables or low-calorie fruits. Then as we get into lower but not super low energy density, this is, you know, greater than 0.5, getting up into the 2 range. We've essentially now, we're including high energy density fruits, yogurts, and then lean proteins. And then once you start getting into moderate and high energy densities of, say, 4 or higher, now we're talking about most mixed ingredient foods or processed foods, which is honestly, I think, much of the issue with passive overconsumption of processed foods that gives them kind of a quote-unquote bad name is probably specifically due to the fact that they do have pretty high energy densities, coupled with the fact that they're easy to eat and you can eat them fast, and it kind of gets past those initial satiety hunger responses. And they're also hyperpalatable, so they drive more.
Boy, are they. They taste wonderful.
Aren't they?
All right, cool. So, I think that's a great, some added context as it pertains to energy density. And yeah, it's one of those things where so far the, for now, looking at this paper and trying to extrapolate, it's kind of a thinking of it conceptually and, you know, how could I use this? Well, if you're about to sit down for dinner and you're like, self-control's kind of wavering right now, I could use a little boost to help me kind of curtail my intake. Maybe before we sit down for that big dinner that I know is coming up, maybe I'll snack on some carrots, right? Or maybe I'll snack on some cucumbers, some celery, something like that. Nothing too extreme, but snack on that leisurely and maybe start, if you're at like a buffet type or a potluck type meal, maybe start with some vegetables and salad. And then for the second plate, you go in for the more energy dense type of item. So the stuff can be used, but like I said, we're extrapolating into some not unknown, but it's extrapolated territory for sure.
Yeah, well said.
Yeah. Had a question in here about stats. I was like, I need to skip that and then take a closer look. Luckily, the answer is simple. So Franklin said, what do you think about multi-level analysis to tease out more interactions via increased statistical power? With multi-level modeling, we can, for example, recruit novice, beginner, intermediate, and advanced lifters and kind of tease out some of those different effects. I'm a huge fan of multi-level models. the challenging thing is it goes by many names. So people talk about multi-level models or linear mixed models or hierarchical models, and there's some slight distinctions of how different applications work, but they're all basically the same thing there. Unfortunately, there's two totally different types of hierarchical models that you could make. But anyway, yeah, mixed models are fantastic. And I will say, Helms, this year, not quite a year yet, but my time I've spent so far at Duke, I've been diving into some new statistical territories that are fascinating and really, really powerful. So linear mixed models, even back toward the end of my PhD, I loved them because I think they're great for longitudinal designs, which we're almost always dealing with. But then I started getting more recently into generalized linear mixed models, where you can then start messing with your conditional distribution families and your link functions. And then I got into generalized additive models, where you can start to add some really wacky, nonlinear, like high order polynomial curves to everything. So all of that is to say, I've been really digging into stats this year, and it's a lot of fun. Multi-level models are terrific, and you can expand upon those. Every step that I just mentioned to kind of pull it back in and contextualize is just like you take a linear mixed model, you add a little bit of extra nuance to it, and you're at a generalized mixed model. Then you add a little more nuance, and you're at this generalized additive model. So keep pushing, Franklin. Work your way up that terrible, tedious mountain. And yeah, these types of models, we can do whatever we want with them. They are really a beautiful thing. Any thoughts on that, Helms?
My thoughts are that I am impressed with the fact that I have reached a level of statistical knowledge that I have some general concept of the words that you said and what they mean, even if I have no capability to implement those models or use the software or the coding that would be needed to use them. But in some cases, I would be able to say, I think this would be an appropriate test for this data set.
That is 99% of the battle, because if you're working in research, someone down the hallway knows someone who can do it. So as long as you know what should be done, that's pretty much all you need. All right, let's get back into fitness stuff and away from this treacherous statistics stuff. So we've got one here. I've read protein intakes above 1.6 grams per kilogram up to 2.4 grams per kilogram are beneficial for prepping bodybuilders. At what point in a cut would you actually increase protein? You know, do you titrate that up based on training, recovery, the timeline itself? How do you do that, Helms? You are, I would say, one of the global leading experts for this question. So I'm going to sit down and learn from the best.
All right. The first thing I want to say is I want to make it very clear, because sometimes my systematic review that was published in 2013 is held up as quote unquote proof that higher protein intakes are better in cases when you have someone who is not overweight, performing resistance training, and is actively in a caloric deficit and losing weight while performing exercise. That systematic review had a quantitative output, but it was not a meta-analysis. And it was also not done in such a way that we could make causative inferences. So what I specifically did in that systematic review is of, I believe, the six studies that met the inclusion criteria, which required, and there may be more than six, or might be seven or five, but this was more than 10 years ago now, and I don't have the paper in front of me, so you'll have to forgive my own forgetfulness of my own data. We extracted lean body mass, fat mass, and also protein intake, and looked at changes over time. And then I simply provided the observation of what protein intakes were associated with non-significant changes in lean body mass, so not losing it, or gaining lean body mass during a cut, and provided that as, hey, this is the intake that was observed to co-occur with negligible losses of lean body mass. And we calculated that relative to fat-free mass, because we could, because I had that data extracted. And that range was 2.3 to 3.1 grams per kilogram of protein per day per unit of fat-free mass, which is roughly equivalent to, for someone of an average, quote-unquote, body composition, what was cited there, around 1.6 to 2.4 grams per kilogram of total body mass. That is a very different thing than to do a meta-analysis of studies that had an experimental design of comparing lower versus higher protein intakes to see which one resulted in better lean mass retention during a cut in resistance trained people who are not overweight, and then reporting the point estimate the meta regression perhaps would probably be the best way to do that, to provide a continuous analysis of protein intake and say, hey, here's where we think that intake is for dieting individuals. That data does not exist. It potentially could exist. Drexler and I had a conversation on Messenger, which I'll share with everyone. Hey, we should do a meta-analysis and regression on this. And then we both went, sweet, do you have the time for that? Absolutely not. Do you? No.
Cool. Well, I corrected you. I said, well, no, someone should.
Someone should. Yes, yeah. You did absolutely correct me. And you know what? This is what good scientists do, like myself, who are in academic positions, and yourself. We find students who don't have the time either, but we can ask them to do it and use our position of power to coerce them into it. And then we provide track changes and tell them, hey, you did this wrong. I'm not going to show you how to change it, but you can. I'm being facetious, but actually I think this would be a potentially good project for a student.
You should know, right now I am advising an undergraduate student who has remarkable potential, like really great student. And I personally was the second person doing all of the title screening, abstract screening. Mm-hmm. So, hey, man, I dug into several hundred texts there. So I'm very proud of myself for not being the go figure it out and I'll give you the track changes. So
and I'm not
we're in the trenches,
either.
Helms. We're in the
yeah,
trenches.
Yeah, we are. I'm not that either for the things I can do.
Yeah.
So 100%. And so that is a really important caveat that answered not the question that was asked. We don't have experimental evidence that suggests what the intake is. It is quite possible, and I will be very open to the possibility that there is only so much of an effect we can get out of protein for mitigating lean mass losses. And even if we don't know if that's true and it doesn't change versus surplus maintenance or energy deficit, I will say that the most important thing that we have, and we can actually say this objectively comparing effect sizes and absolute losses of lean mass, to prevent lean masses during a cut, is a sound resistance training program, far and away. A distant second is not dieting too fast. Having a reasonable energy deficit that is probably having you lose in the range of 0.5 to 1% of your body weight per week. And I would say that there's some observational data that would indicate slower than that is probably better, especially when you're leaner. And then a distant third is having a higher protein intake. And I think at best we can say that the range is discussed, you know, roughly 2 to 3 grams per kilogram of fat-free mass. That's kind of that's what I'm going to go with for the third edition, sneak peek, because 2.3 to 3.1, why? It's observational anyway, based upon 6 studies.
Wait, run that range by me again?
2 to 3 grams per kilogram of fat-free mass.
Okay.
Yeah. And we'll see if that gets past my editor.
Yeah, we'll see.
Yeah. And again, these are the muscle and strength pyramids, not the, hey, casually exercising vegetarian, person dieting to lose 5% of your body weight. This is people who are trying to cross T's, dot I's, dot J's, and all the above. I think that's a reasonable recommendation. And I don't think, and importantly, the question implies, hey, when should I up it through this range, or how should I modify it over time? I have no confidence that 3 grams per kilogram of fat-free mass is better than 2 grams per kilogram of fat-free mass in this state. And the context by which you would choose to try higher or lower would largely be based upon what your total energy budget is. If you have to go to 3 grams per kilogram of fat-free mass and you think that's better, but it results in you only consuming, say, a double-digit amount of carbohydrates or dropping your fats down to very low levels, that's probably not worth it. So you need to think about when you're on a calorie budget that you don't want to just say more is better. In fact, I'm much more comfortable with someone who has 3,000 calories to play with blowing the protein recommendation out of the water and saying, yeah, you don't need to go over 1.6 grams per kilogram or 0.7 gram per pound. And you're like, well, I'm at 1.5 grams per pound, but I'm fine because I'm eating 300 grams of carbs plus per day and 70 grams of fat plus per day. And I only weigh 80 kilos. I'm like, well, it's honestly, at this point, we're in nutrient excess. It does not matter. You could trade those carbs for protein. You could trade those fats for protein. And so long as you're taking in enough, it's not going to make a difference. So during prep, that's not the case. You have an energy budget. And even those who are looking to leverage other beneficial effects of higher protein intakes, like perhaps the higher thermic effect of food, maybe trying to get a little more on the energy expenditure side of the equation, that's a very small amount that going even from 2 to 3 probably would not result in much in terms of increasing energy expenditure. And the satiety-related effects, we don't have consistent data on that. It could be beneficial, but the important thing to remember is we don't eat protein, carbs, and fats. We eat foods which contain protein, carbs, and fats. And you could compare two diets of the same carbohydrate and protein intake. And if one of them did not include as much fruit, vegetables, low energy density foods, and fiber, but had a higher protein intake, I would anticipate that the satiety effect would be less than one that had a higher protein intake, but had less of those foods, which were lower energy density. So there's a lot of complexity here. While theoretically higher protein intakes do make sense during a deficit, I think to make sure that you don't accidentally rob Peter to pay Paul and drop your carbohydrates and fats too low, but I do think it should be constrained to that 2 to 3 gram per kilogram of fat-free mass per day intake with whatever allows for a better overall conducive diet that enhances adherence, satiety, and maintains performance in the gym should be where you choose in that 2 to 3 gram per kilogram range. End of my
rant. Yeah, I was just crunching some numbers. I don't do a lot of good mental math. So here's one question that I'd follow up with here, right? Mm-hmm. So if you think about a prep, right? So 80 kilograms, that's to real freedom units, that's 176. And what, 65 kilograms to pounds?
143.
Is 143. So that's like not a crazy cut, right? For a prepping bodybuilder, that's like a pretty normal range, you know, for like a lightweight bodybuilder. Start up around there, right? So let's say you started that prep and you're having 180 grams of protein a day, right? And you divide that by, I think we said we're starting at 80 kilograms. You're at 2.25 grams per kilogram. If you just keep eating 180 and you divide it by that 65 kilograms at the end, you have bumped your protein from 2.25 to 2.77. So like a lot of times when I get this question, I often say like, when they say like, well, when do you bump it during prep? I usually say, maybe you don't, right?
I never do.
Yeah. So like you basically, I might be rephrasing what you already said when I was crunching my numbers, but if I did, I apologize. But
No. I didn't actually say this. And it's a really good point.
Yeah, because sometimes you actually find that you have bumped yourself into this higher end of the range by simply eating the same thing and then weighing less because we have weight in the denominator.
Another interesting thing, Trex, is that your protein quality actually increases during most preps.
Mm-hmm.
You're like, why? If I didn't change my protein intake?
Yeah.
So when you're, let's take the same example and let's assume very little metabolic adaptation. So let's say this person at 80 kilograms is needing to consume 2,500 calories to be at an appropriate rate of weight loss. When they're trying to go from 65 to 60, very plausible that they might need to be at 2,000 calories, largely driven by their lower body weight and the effect on energy expenditure and some predictable downregulation and energy expenditure from the thermic effect of food and some drops in NEAT. When you're eating 2,500 calories and you have 180 grams of protein and you're counting all sources as you should, there is probably about 20 to 30 grams of that that is coming from indirect, non-high quality, quote-unquote, protein sources. When you're consuming 2,000 calories, that percentage is probably about 10 grams lower. So it means you're getting 180 grams of protein. And now instead of 160 grams of it being high, quote unquote, quality, now 170 grams is because you just have less carbs and fats in your diet and less, extraneous foods that aren't typically protein-based providing it. So not only have you gone from closer to 2 to closer to 3 grams per kg of protein, but you've also increased the relative content of essential amino acids. And that's why I never plan, that's the only thing I can say, to increase protein during a diet. The only times I do are when the individual is struggling with satiety and they think, especially, or I think for some reason, that perhaps a higher protein diet could be beneficial for them in that case. Maybe they've had prior experience with it. maybe were already playing with the lower end because they really wanted to eat more carbs and fats. And I'm finding that their cravings are maybe affected by the food setup we have. And I think they would do better with maybe reducing their carbohydrates a bit and increasing their protein or fats or vice versa. And it is one of many potential satiety-inducing strategies, but actually relatively low on my list and not my go-to by any means. And the typical thing I do is I set protein intake at a certain intake during the start of the diet, which may or may not be higher than their off-season intake. For example, if they're eating a very high calorie intake in the off-season, it's hard not to have a protein intake for a bodybuilder in excess of what is needed. And we may just keep it there. Not uncommon at all. And there's even times I've decreased protein intake from the start of the off-season to the start of prep because they were already well in excess of where it needed to be.
Yeah, I hear you. All right, man. So I know that you have a hard stop at 8. Okay, so
do
8 in real time, whatever the heck time it is out there, you know, whatever. So
fake New Zealand time.
Exactly. So if you need to hop off, just hop off. I'm going to be wrapping up the episode here, but there were a few quick things that I wanted to address here. So like rapid fire questions. Someone asked a little bit about, you know, they want to grow their neck musculature, but they're a little bit concerned about the risk of sleep apnea. And they're wondering, you know, if they need to be concerned about that. And I don't know a ton about sleep apnea, but I did used to wrestle, and it's hard to wrestle without getting a much thicker neck. And you don't really see a pervasive issue of sleep apnea among wrestlers. And the reason I say that is because, like, literally the sport of wrestling is having a human your size hanging on your neck maliciously all day, every day, forever. So your neck gets thick and strong, and that's great. A lot of football players, American football, very deliberately build up their neck musculature to reduce the likelihood of catastrophic head and neck injuries. We don't really see a ton of sleep apnea in the skill positions in football. I am of the opinion, not a medical opinion, but an Eric living his life opinion, that the real the more pressing concern outside of, you know, genetic predisposition with sleep apnea is adiposity, specifically adiposity of the tongue itself. Your tongue actually does gain and lose fat. And then also with folks who are on very potent anabolics, the growth of essentially everything, like the tongue and all those weird little muscles in the neck that aren't really doing a whole lot in your training. I think that those are probably the more prevalent issues, along with just, you know, increased adiposity in general. So I personally would not constrain my direct neck training due to a concern about sleep apnea unless I had some other medical history that would be kind of reinforcing those concerns.
I'll co-sign that. Being involved a lot in powerlifting and drug-tested bodybuilding and powerlifting, and also knowing a fair number of enhanced individuals, the observations, anecdotal data I have are that, yes, it occurs quite frequently in obesity, which also makes me think it is tongue adiposity. And people just forget that there are androgen receptors everywhere and that enhanced bodybuilders are not just taking even androgens, and there are growth hormone receptors everywhere. So even in very high-level lean bodybuilders who are enhanced, they may be getting similar effects, although, you know, muscular growth related or non-adipose tissue related growth that has a similar effect as having a fatty tongue. But I don't hear it almost ever from lower weight classes of natural bodybuilders or powerlifters, even quite muscular ones. And that typically is exclusive to people who are competing at a weight class that is disproportionately high for their height, or they're in the unlimited weight classes like the 120 plus, 84 plus. So yeah. Cosine.
Good stuff. Someone asked a little bit about the current wave of baseball elbow injuries. What might be contributing? And they said, is it the pitch clock, the higher velocities, greater use of off-speed pitches? If I had to guess, Helms, I don't know if you care about this at all, but I've been going to some baseball games lately. People just throw really hard now. I think it's a combination of, like, back in the day when someone was throwing 97, it was an attraction. You'd be like, oh my God, they're coming into town. It's going to be wild. nowadays it's like every person out of the bullpen is throwing like 102. I mean, the velocities are getting crazy. Elbows aren't made for that. And as these velocities have gotten crazy, it's also coincided with, I mean, these kids play baseball year round from the age of like 7 to now they're like 37, right? And it's like, hey, why can't my elbow hold up with me throwing, you know, a high pitch count, throwing 103 on my fastball? And it's like, because you're made out of normal stuff. You're made out of human tissues and stuff, man. So, yeah, these UCL injuries that are really prevalent, I think the sport, it's just it's a high volume, many years, tremendously high torque movement. And I will say this, softball got it right. Humans were not meant to throw overhead. We just weren't. Underhand throwing is where it's at.
Trex, my only contribution to this is to say that my status as a legitimate sports scientist is completely dependent upon the status of bodybuilding and powerlifting being considered sports. Yeah. And that's my contribution.
I hear you, man. Yeah, I will say this, though. I do have a buddy who I did my PhD with, and all of his research was on baseball pitching, like almost all of it. And he currently has like a semi, he has a very, you know, traditional, legitimate academic job, but he does a lot of work with Major League Baseball teams. So I might need to drop him a text or an email and see if he has any, because he would know so much more than me. Like, this is just me. I'm like anyone else sitting on their couch saying, man, these guys throw fast. But he would actually know. So I might try to give an update here in a future episode. But I tell you what, there was one other I was going to get to, but I think we're basically out of time here. One last one very quickly. Someone asked, for someone with a slightly unrelated degree who wants to do a health-related graduate degree, how much supplemental coursework would be needed? Very easy answer. Just get in touch with the program that you're interested in applying to, and they'll all kind of have their own policies about what prerequisites are necessary. They'll generally tend to be similar. You know, programs kind of look around and say, okay, what's expected here? So it won't be like totally different from one program to the next usually, but yeah, contact professors, contact programs and say, here's what I've done. Here's what the program I'd like to get into. How do we make this work?
Yeah. Only thing I'd have to add there is there's a big difference between getting a degree in, let's say, integrative biology with a concentration in exercise physiology or kinesiology with a focus on biomechanics and a general exercise science degree. A sports science degree or a dietetics program or nutritional biochemistry versus a general nutrition class. So, for example, if I had gone down and I explored each of these routes, I would have needed an additional year of taking calculus, trig, and more advanced math to get into more advanced physics to then take the biomechanics courses necessary. Again, this is, we're talking 10 plus years ago. And then similarly, to go down the nutritional biochemistry or RD route, I would have had to go into organic chemistry and then further. And I did none of those things. And I went the sports science pathway so that I am great at telling bodybuilders what to do. But if you ask me to do more than add up the change in your pocket, it's not going to happen.
Yeah. Yeah. I also thought about going the RD route at one point, and it was the undergrad prerequisites that steered me away. I was like, I can't do it. It's too much extra time. I think it would have taken me at least a year and a half before I started then the master's degree.
But then you got the internship.
Oh, and the internship, which is
ours.
Conveniently unpaid, which is a great way to do it. But I think they're all unpaid. I could be wrong, but anyway, yeah. So dietetics, there's a lot of hoops to jump through, but it's a tremendous profession to get into if you're willing to jump. All right, Helms, I know you got to go, so I'll close out the episode. Thanks so much for joining us. Take care. Folks, I just want to say Helms is the hero of the night. You can go. I'm going to talk about you. So preferable if you go. So Helms is the hero of the night because he wasn't even scheduled. He like last minute offered to jump on because we had a little scheduling change up there. So huge thanks to Helms for his incredible contributions tonight. I will be back next week with another episode. We have had some chats. It may be actually on April 16th instead of 17th. We need to figure that out internally, but once we make that decision final, we will make people aware of it. So keep an eye on our YouTube. We'll have the date up there early, and keep an eye on our Instagram. We'll make sure that we post about it. Instagram is at Mass Research Review. So keep an eye on those channels. We'll let you know if we're going to do April 16th or 17th, but we will have an episode next week, and we hope that you'll be able to join us. So thanks so much, everyone in the chat. Thanks so much to everyone listening outside of the chat. Take care and have a fantastic week.